with Harold Prochette, May 24, 1976. The material to be used for the Life and Times of Arthur Evans. Harold, where did yours and father's paths first cross?
Well, if my memory serves me correctly, I was called to a workers' paper conference in New Westminster on 10th Street in a workers' home. I don't remember the worker's name, but Art came there as a spokesman for the DC Workers News, which there was a campaign on for circulation and finances. And there must have been 30 people present, and Art spoke on the importance of the workers' press in the class struggle. And I was very impressed with his presentation. That's my first experience with Art.
Do you know what he was doing for a living at that time?
I believe he was active in the Workers' Unity League, but whether he had yet started to organize Mine Mill, I think he was organizing the unemployed.
The unemployed.
I believe it was a single unemployed.
Very good. Did you ever have any association with him regarding the unemployed?
Well, from time to time our paths would cross as the unemployed provincial council was called together, and I was a representative of the unemployed in Coquitlam.
Could I first...
Millardville.
What provincial convention are we talking about?
Well, it wasn't a provincial convention. This would be a provincial conference of the unemployed sections.
Right.
We had a neighborhood councils and sections and block committees.
Right.
And he was the chairman, I believe, of the Provincial Council of Unemployed in D.C.
Very good.
That's where I first had any organizational experience with him.
Before we go any further, could you give me some descriptions of what your block committees did?
Well, of course, the block committees organized demonstrations for when people were cut off relief, were denied relief, where there was evictions, where lights were being turned off for non-payment to the BC Electric. And we got together and supported all strikes by refusing to cross picket lines and to back up picket lines. The first time in the history of the labor movement in British Columbia when the unemployed were organized to support the employed rather than to scab.
That
was a very important factor. Yeah. And Art played a very important role in that. I should say that we in Millardville and Coquitlam could mobilize our unemployed council for a demonstration of the membership inside of 2 hours. That's how fast we could do it.
Very good.
We demonstrated in the City Hall a number of times, especially when R.C. MacDonald, the Reeves of Coquitlam, later to become the Minister of Mines in the Johnson-Anscombe coalition government, cut us off relief. We demonstrated and kept the council in jail all night.
You were a single unemployed at this time. You
no,
were married.
I was a married man.
You were a married man.
I was blacklisted from the Fraser Mill strike as a shingles sawyer. I led the strike in 31, and I couldn't get a job anywhere, so I became unemployed. I raised my 5 sons and my wife in a shack on $47.50 a month for 3 years.
Good.
So our connection with the unemployed organization in British Columbia was quite substantial. And I remember us organizing the trek, in which Arthur Evans led the trek to Victoria.
What year would that be, Harold?
That, I believe, was in 1932, or possibly 33. I'm not sure of that date.
Fine.
Those of us that went over on the CPR were asked by Arthur to turn our tickets in and go back on the fish packer, which we did, in order to allow the older people and the women to come back on the CPR. And it was quite an experience. We run into a very heavy storm, and everybody aboard but Art and the captain and Len Hashey were sick. Len Hashey was the secretary of the unemployed in Millardville.
Very good.
He's now a lumber operator.
I find sometimes positions change quite a bit, don't they?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me, to your knowledge, what positions or what activity did Father have with the Communist Party in these early years?
Well, he was a member of the Provincial Committee of the Communist Party of British Columbia, and I believe he was a member of the National Committee. He was also an active member in the Workers' Union League, which was doing the job of organizing the basic industries.
You also were an organizer of the Workers' Unity League, were you?
Well, I was an organizer and leader in the Lumber and Sawmill Workers' Union, which is a section of the Workers' Unity League. The Workers' Unity League was the National Council, which Art was a member of the National Council. And he was a representative on the National Council of the Single Unemployed, and led the trek, if you remember,
right,
to Ottawa, and got as far as Regina, and then it was broken up there, and he met with R.B. Bennett. Tom McEwen, he and Tom McEwen led the delegation and met with Bennett, the Prime Minister.
Were you ever in any conventions in B.C. that Father was at? I'd like to know where your paths perhaps touched.
Yes, the date I'm not sure of, but it was the Provincial Convention of the Communist Party, and Arthur was selected as the chairman of the convention. I remember it so vividly because he was one of the best chairmen I'd seen in action. He kept the convention in perfect order, and the business rolled along very well, and I learned a lot from his chairmanship. Then I met him again in a conference in a vacant store at the corner of Fraser Avenue in Vancouver and 25th Avenue. The visiting speaker was Misha Cohen from Toronto, a member of the National Committee. And the party was illegal and underground at the time, and it was a more or less secret affair, an underground affair. That I saw Art there then.
Very good. You were saying that Father was a good chairman. Would you give me your description of Arthur as an organizer?
Oh, he's one of the best organizers I ever saw. He was not only an organizer, he was an agitator, propagandist. He could write, he could speak, and he could organize. And he was a fearless person, absolutely fearless. He didn't give a damn about anybody, including all the bosses and all the armed forces of the state. And
Would you give me some examples of what the state forces do to people on strike, ones of your own knowledge? I'm thinking particularly of clubbing, viciousness, breaking picket lines.
Yes, well, of course, the state is used against the working class to protect the interests of the minority, the boss class. And they'll resort to any means to maintain themselves, such as clubbing and starving, jailing, injunctions. In fact, everything in the book they would use against the working class. the labor movement, all the way from the fight for the 8-hour day, right up to including the present day fight against inflation and unemployment, the twin menace of society. And it'll continue as long as the capitalist state exists. They resort to anything, including murder.
Yes. Before we turned on the tape, you were telling me about Antioch. What happened there?
Well, I wasn't there, but I remember it so vividly, the time that Art led the strikers in Antioch, the company town, and the provincial police with the company stooges used a bulldozer to move the picket line, and in doing so injured quite a number of the women, wives of the strikers, wives and family of the strikers. And Art was arrested and charged with inciting to riot and unlawful assembly. And I was in the House the day that the Attorney General, could you remember his name?
Pooley,
right. Mr. Pooley made an attack on the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Union, or the Workers Unity League as it was then, an affiliate of the Workers Unity League, the Miners Union, and Art especially, and had produced bars of iron to prove that they were using these illegal weapons. He had them on his desk when he was speaking, and he made a vicious attack on Art and the union, and in support of anti-labor legislation such as Bill 98. I say I was in the House when he presented the case of the bosses, actually.
I'm sure Father would have liked to have answered that.
Oh, he would have. I think he was in jail at the time.
Yes. Good.
And he was found guilty of those charges by the capitalist court, and I've forgotten now what the term was.
He was charged under Section 98.
And he went to jail for a year?
He was given 1 year, and through their finagling, he got 18 months, with his sentence not starting till his appeal.
They extended it over the 1 year. Right, I remember that.
Also, can you give me a description of Dad as a man? I know him as a father with a great sense of humor, but I also know him as sardonic, witty, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was a fine, upright, working class leader. He stood over 6 feet, and as I said before, he was absolutely fearless. He had a great love for the working class. He had a sense of humor, and he was very witty, and he was a kind of a person that you could support. Everybody loved him. Everybody thought so much of Art and admired his qualities as an outstanding leader, from Comrade Tim Buck down.
Are there any incidents that I have missed, not knowing altogether where you did have your paths crossed, what your associations were, that you would like to tell me about, Harold?
Well, we've dealt with the party convention and the party conference.
Okay. How about, were you active, either or both of you, in the Canadian Labor Defense League?
Well, I was just a member in the Canadian Labor Defense League. I remember Art was very active with Becky Buey and others. I remember so well the massacre of the miners in Alberta. What was the name of that town? Yes.
Yeah, just remember the name of the place.
Yes, the Workers' Union League had organized the coal miners in Estevan, and Annie Buller, as a member of the National Committee of the Workers' Union League, went to Estevan to help the strikers. The RCMP were mobilized by the state and stopped the demonstration on a Sunday. And the demonstration took the form of a peaceful march, which was broken up by the RCMP, and they used guns and killed three miners. Annie Buller was not present at the moment, but she was arrested and charged with unlawful assembly, and the courts gave her 1 year in jail. She came to Millardville during the prisonal strike and spoke to the strikers, and she made such an outstanding appeal for support for the Estevan miners that the strikers gave her about $1,500 in cash out of their own pocket.
There were also three miners killed at Estevan, too, weren't there?
Three miners were shot.
Yeah.
Tom Douglas, our communist counselor in Coquitlam, we elected three times in succession, a great friend of ours.
Oh, yeah.
I was his campaign manager. He was elected with the highest vote ever electing any member of Coquitlam Council. He was shot in his gas station by a so-called unemployed worker. And I don't know whether Art was present, but we had at least 6,000 people at Tom Douglas's funeral.
Good heavens.
And there were so many people in the funeral home that the floor collapsed.
Well,
went down a foot. And we marched the streets of Columbia Street into Westminster with his casket carried shoulder high and all the flowers being carried by the mourners. And everybody that was anybody in politics turned out for and against the communists,
yeah,
in recognition of Tom Douglas's contribution. He was always known in the in the Association of Municipalities as the senator. He spoke on the question of unemployment and war and peace and so on all the time, just like Harry Rankin does today.
Right.
Your father knew Tom Douglas and they were personal friends.
Very good. We were talking about the Canadian Labor Defense League. We talked about Estevan. To your knowledge, did Father try to raise support for other than Estevan people through the Canadian Labor Defense League?
Yes, I remember Art one time, in defiance of the coal miners' convention and constitution and John L. Lewis, was sent to jail for using the per capita tax collected by the local for bread and food for the strikers. And he went to jail for that.
Well, he didn't like potbelly parasites, no matter which side of the table they came from.
Later, it's very funny, you know, when John L. Lewis left the AFL and set up the Canadian Congress, CIO, I was a member of the National Committee, the International Committee of the CIO, and I sat with John L. Lewis for 5 years on the executive.
Right.
So I got to know him pretty well. At that time, he was pursuing a very progressive role in the fight to organize the basic industries of the North American continent,
mm-hmm,
which we gave full support.
Yeah.
And in spite of the fact that he was one of the his past was one of the worst red baiters in the history of the labor movement. He expelled communists, locals, lifted charters, expelled leaders. He was the most ruthless anti-communist. He defied Bill Green and the Executive Council, who refused to organize the basic industries and continued to organize only the crafts. And he did a very important contribution in
and Father and he were together in the CIO then.
Well, I presume that the mine mill and the coal miners had become part of the CIO when your father was still alive. So naturally, he supported John L. Lewis in the drive to organize the unorganized.
Right. And who had changed, father or John L.?
Well, John L., of course. I remember your dad receiving the appointment from the mine mill as the organizer in Trail for the mine mill. And he came to me at the time and sought support, as he did with others, to purchase a sound truck. And we helped him to raise the money to buy the sound truck. And Blaylock didn't like the sound truck. And Sunday morning, Art woke up to find the sound truck down the bottom of the ravine. That finished the sound truck, but it didn't finish Art.
No. We're talking about money and organizing. One area I didn't ask you about, the Workers' Unity League. My impression is that one did your organizing with empty pockets and perhaps no place to sleep. Could you give me your impressions of the kind of money you had in those days to organize with?
For example, in the Lumber and Sawmill Workers Union, which is an affiliate of the Workers Union League, we ran into all kinds of opposition from the bosses, the press, and the radio. There was no television then. They launched an attack on us three times a day. One would be paid by the Shingle Manufacturers Association, the next one would be paid by the Lumber Manufacturers Association, and the next would be paid by the Boss Loggers, all of which came together into one association eventually. But we paid our organizers $5 a week if we had it. And if their shoes wore out, we'd have them half-soled for $1. And if they were working in the city, and could travel on the BC Collectric, as old Bill used to call it. We'd give them a car pass, a weekly car pass for $1.25. So they got $5 plus a car pass, if there was $5 to give them. Mm-hmm. Of course, if it was a question of whether a leaflet should go out or the $5 should be paid, the leaflet usually went out.
Right.
So that it was pretty tough. Hard times. You had to be a real stalwart of the labor movement to organize in those days in the 130s.
Tell me, what was the burning drive that kept some of you continuing? And obviously you might have been able to earn a living.
Well, it was class consciousness. And the class consciousness developed a political consciousness. You learned in the process of Scurlo what determines your position in society. And of course, your position is determined by your relationship to production. We produce everything, we own nothing. The bosses produce nothing and own everything. So that class consciousness stood us in good stead as communists. Now today we have what we call class collaborationists, who are more interested in promoting themselves than they are in promoting the class struggle. And I can count, since 1948, 22 top officials of the IWA, all members of the NDP, unfortunately, that are now working for the boss for as high as $40,000 a year, plus, have gone over.
Yeah.
The latest was Jubenville and Duncan, Focal 80, and he's working out for $40,000 a year. And he came to me in this very house, sitting where you are now, with a bottle of whiskey to try and convince me he should run for president against Moore. And I said, you haven't got a chance. Why not? Well, I says, first of all, you haven't got a program that would interest the working class. Secondly, you haven't got a well-balanced slate. He says, what do you mean by a well-balanced slate? And I said, well, you could have some NDPers and some communists. Or he said he couldn't go for that. And I said, no, well, you couldn't get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, one thing you must remember, that the working class in the woodworking industry, and I presume that applied to all other industries, had confidence in the communists because they knew the communists wouldn't sell them out.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean to say the individual is infallible, because they're not.
No.
But the party is infallible. And while the individual, and we only lost one to the boss, and you lost 22 since 48, we only lost one. I won't even mention his name.
Right.
He was one of the original organizers of Wood and became the personnel manager of Skagit Lodge.
Well, that's a better record.
Yeah. So that's the difference between class consciousness and class collaborationist. And that's the problem of the woodworkers today, is that the leadership is more concerned about promoting themselves than they are in promoting the interests of the working class. That's it. And the difference is, when I was international president, I was getting $75 a week. I took 50, left 25 in. Now they take nothing of $350 a week, and even more.
I can remember Father getting $200 in trail and telling my mother we had to live on $100 because $100 had to go back in.
Right, sure, right. Yeah, my dad said to me, he was an old conservative, he lived to be 91. He was a great friend of Thurston Favelle, where I first started to work when I was 15 years of age, 10 cents an hour, 10 hours a day.
Right.
And he had a talk with Favelle. I'd been on relief then about 2 years. And he said, he came to me and he said, I just have to talk to Mr. Favelle. And he says, you can go to work tomorrow at his shingle mill in Port Moody. And I said, in what conditions? Well, he says, you just drop your socialistic ideas and you're one of the best soldiers in the country, we'll hire you tomorrow. And I grinned, you know. He said, what are you grinning at? I said, do you expect a fish to live out of water, Pop? Oh, forget that. He says, these children have got to be fed. And I said, they're being fed. I used to cut my wood in the bush and had a big garden. And my brother didn't charge us any rent, so we got by. And then I got contributions from people that were working.
Right.
And even with that, they cut my lights off.
Well, if you had electrician friends like we did, they used to hook them up again for
right.
you. Harold, I thoroughly enjoyed this. Is there anything else that you would like to tell me that you can remember of Father? Or?
Well, the only other occasion, and I wasn't very close to that, was the trek. When the trek started out without art, on the ground that he was a well-known communist, and the bosses and the government would try and use the fact that he was led by a communist to discredit the trek. And they hadn't got out of Vancouver hardly until a telegram came back demanding that Art come lead the trek, and he did.
Can you tell me, Harold, whose decision was it that perhaps he shouldn't?
Well, I believe it was discussed in the provincial committee of the party, and it was agreed as a tactic that Art shouldn't go on the trek, but if the demand did develop, that he should go then.
Right.
And the demand did develop, and away he went. He caught up with him on the next freight.
Yes, freight. Yes.
I remember him pulling out of Vancouver. I was there at the longshore strike when George Brown and Salonen and I met him at Longview, Washington, and since the American, what was his name, the guy with the Victoria Cross?
Oh, yes.
O'Leary? No.
No. But I'll get
O'Rourke.
Yeah. Mickey.
Eh?
Mickey O'Rourke.
Yes, Mickey.
Right.
He led the demonstration, and the police broke up the demonstration. I was there. And that was called the Battle of the Ballantine Pier.
Yeah.
I have pictures somewhere. I haven't been able to find them lately. Of those horse policemen breaking up the strike.
Yeah.
And the funny part was, all along those houses on Alexander Street, women were throwing out cans and baskets of bolts and nuts to throw at the cops.
They weren't too popular, were they, in those
they
days?
Were especially Scanlon.
Yes, everyone I've interviewed remembers him.
Scanlon was no friend of Art's.
No.
Art, you should pick him out. There's that also.
Yes, yes. He had a lot of pet names for
too. You know, Scanlon was run off the shipyards, you know, during the war. They hired him as a guard.
Yeah.
And they shut down the shipyard and chased him out.
I believe some of those men had been the unemployed in Vancouver and refused.
Sure, right. Yeah. I don't know where Art was in the post office, do you know?
Yes, we were in Trail then.
Trail.
Yeah.
So he missed out on that. I was in the States, so I missed out on it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course I've heard all about it since, how they people turned out by the thousands that night to see the delegation off to Victoria.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a cop in sight.
No, I interviewed Mr. Brody, who was also on the On to Ottawa trek, and I've read his latest
book.
And
you talked to Effie.
Hal, could you tell me some of the areas that the Workers' Unity League did organize in British Columbia, or all of Canada for that matter?
Well, in the case of my own experience, the woodworkers, the Lumber and Sawmill Workers' Union, affiliated to Workers' Unity League.
Right.
That was my personal experience. In addition to that, John L. Lewis and his coal miners weren't doing so well, and the Workers' Unity League established the Canadian Union of Coal Miners. In addition, they established the Canadian Union of Metal Workers, Metal Miners.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there was the Farmers' Unity League,
right,
which they had their own paper called The Furrow, and the Unemployed.